Many of us, at one time or another, have enjoyed relaxing back into the fantasy that we'd be happier living in a different time, somewhere in the past when life was slower, the air was less polluted, and just perhaps people were nicer. Rod Serling wrote more than one Twilight Zone episode about this urge. One of the best was a first season episode called A Stop at Willoughby, about a truly harassed and depressed advertising executive named Gart Williams, who discovers his commuter train home from work makes a stop in 1888 in the town of Willoughby. Spoilers for this 60-year-old television program if you haven't seen it, but here's the closing narration, voiced by the author, Rod Serling himself.
Willoughby? Maybe it's wishful thinking nestled in a hidden part of a man's mind. Or maybe it's the last stop in the vast design of things. Or perhaps for a man like Mr. Gart Williams, who climbed on a world that went by too fast, it's a place around the bend where he could jump off. Willoughby, whatever it is, it comes with sunlight and serenity, and is a part of the Twilight Zone.
Sunlight and serenity, it's what we all crave, and yet they didn't have it back then either. The 1880s are almost on the cusp of modernity, but you don't have to go too far back from that for two very scary words to surface, pre-anesthetic dentistry. And just restricting ourselves to medicine, you still had yellow fever and malaria and an endless number of problems that we cope with rather easily today, or at least we can attempt to cope with them, whereas today they'd just be planning your funeral right off the bat. Take Hall of Fame pitcher Adrian C. Joss, Addie Joss, born 1880, and one of the best pitchers in baseball, top five, right after the turn of the century. He was 6'3", tall for the day, lanky, with long arms, and although he threw hard, one secret to his success was that those arms allowed him to create a deceptive delivery. On his pivot, he would turn away from the plate, his back was almost to the hitter, and he would tuck his hands behind his legs. So the ball would disappear for a bit, and then he would whip that arm around, and the batter would have very little time to guess at the trajectory. He also had exemplary command, despite his unorthodox delivery. He never walked anyone, led the league in walks per nine innings twice, one year with .8. He also was very hard to hit for power, and I realize it was the dead ball era, but he twice went full seasons without allowing any home runs whatsoever. In terms of wins above replacement for the years of his career, Baseball Reference said he was the fifth best pitcher. You had Christy Mathewson, Cy Young, Gettysburg Eddie Plank, Rube Waddell, and then Joss and Mordecai Three Finger Brown are about tied for number five. In terms of park and league adjusted ERA, he was fourth. Although after Three Finger Brown, who was number one, there are six pitchers in a bunch. Ed Walsh, Mathewson, then Joss, Noodles Hahn, who we don't remember quite as well, and Ed Rolbach. And then there's Walter Johnson. Johnson was only just getting started, and his best years were actually ahead of him. So this is not meant to say that Joss was as or more effective than the big train, just that the big train was a little bit younger and hadn't gotten there yet. It's very difficult to make direct comparisons between players from over 100 years ago and now. The game is so different. But broadly speaking, I think that Joss was kind of a Greg Maddux type. He had exemplary control. He threw ground balls. He was reputed to be intelligent. He worked as a columnist for one of the Toledo papers in the off-season, and those columns were said to be pretty good, too. But we have to guess a lot when talking about what kind of player he was, and this isn't just because of the long distance from our time to his, but because even though Joss is a Hall of Famer and was the subject of a long Hall of Fame campaign before he got there, and he wasn't inducted until 1978, there hasn't been a whole lot written about him. That's because he didn't live long enough to write his memoirs or be interviewed countless times about my greatest day in baseball. We know that he was born in Wisconsin. We know his dad was a Swiss immigrant who came to Wisconsin to become a cheesemaker. And this is one of the wonderful things about America and about baseball, that within one generation, your family can go from yodeling and cheddar curds to dominating the major leagues. His dad drank a lot and died when Addy was young, and his mom had enough children to care for that she kind of farmed him out to one of his relatives. That's the way it was in those days. If you had a lot of them, you wouldn't miss one. That's entirely glib, actually. It's that there was no social safety net whatsoever. So if you were a widow with multiple children at a time when women weren't expected to work or couldn't get the good jobs anyway, you'd better have the opportunity to farm out some kids or you were going to starve. Joss was a highly sought-after prospect. The Brooklyn Dodgers pressed really hard to get him to come to town, but ultimately he wanted to stay more local than that, and he spent his entire career with the Cleveland team in the American League, which was known not as the Indians in those days, but as the Naps for most of his career, after second baseman Nap Lajoie. Even though he did have a 9-year career in which he won 2 ERA titles, led the league in wins one season with 27, and pitched to a career ERA of 1.89, which is ridiculous even for the dead ball era, his career is remembered almost for one game. On October 2nd, 1908, there was about a week left in the American League schedule. The Detroit Tigers led the second-place Naps by half a game and the third-place White Sox by a game and a half. On that day, the Naps and the White Sox played, and Joss tangled with another future Hall of Fame pitcher, Big Ed Walsh. There was no bullpenning in 1908, and Walsh would pitch 464 innings and complete 42 games. He won 40 of them. He went 40-15 with a 1.42 ERA, and he struck out 269. Well, in this game, he was tremendous, striking out 15 and allowing but one run on a passed ball. Joss was better than that. He only struck out 3, but he threw a perfect game, and think about how hard it must have been. Just what the odds against throwing a perfect game were in 1908 when fielders are still wearing tiny little gloves and making 40 errors a season. He walked no one, he allowed only 4 balls out of the infield, and the Naps won the game. But that was one game and one day, and the universe keeps making its plans and grinding on, regardless of the glory of that one day. One of the best poems I ever read was by E.E. Cummings, and it's called Buffalo Bills. It's very brief. He wrote, "Buffalo Bills defunct, who used to ride a water-smooth silver stallion and break 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pigeons just like that. Jesus, he was a handsome man. And what I want to know is, how do you like your blue-eyed boy, Mr. Death?" Grabbing the text of that poem online a few minutes ago, I saw that someone had written an essay about it, and the author contended that Cummings' meaning was too vague to nail down. That's not true. Cummings was working the same territory that Percy Bysshe Shelley hit with Ozymandias. "Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away." Which is to say that not only can you pitch the great games, you can write all the baseball columns you want and get all the clicks on them that you like, or even do baseball podcasts, my brothers and sisters, and yet, once you're gone, with very rare exceptions, all is dust and amnesia. As I said, Joss had a very short career. The Hall of Fame had to waive its 10-year requirement just to get him in. Now, when a pitcher does have a 1.89 ERA over 9 seasons, he's exactly the kind of guy who should make you think about bending the rules. You created the rules, you can bend them. It took the constipated institution known as the Hall of Fame 67 years to figure this out, although that's not fair because for about half those years there was no Hall of Fame, but you get what I'm saying. Call it about 40 years that it took them to figure this out. You may be asking by now why they needed to figure that out, why Joss's career was so brief. And the answer is kind of interesting because it was over for a couple of reasons. It might have continued to be over, but we'll never know. Joss had some problems that the world was not well equipped to deal with. For all practical purposes, his career came to an end on July 25th, 1910, when he was just 30 years old. He had elbow problems. He was diagnosed with elbow tendonitis, and despite a winter's rest, the problem persisted into spring training 1911, so that on the eve of the season's beginning, his arm had been placed in a cast for want of anything better to do. Back then, the diagnosis was no better than a guess, and his arm could have been broken or had mice in it. Still, they thought he'd be back, and up to a week or so before the end, he was fine other than the bad wing. And then he was fatigued and feverish, had a cough, had a headache, was maybe a little bit disoriented. They put him to bed. Doctor said he had pleurisy. When he didn't get better, they revised the diagnosis to pleurisy, complicated with water on the chest, and brain trouble.
I've gotten the results of your tests.
I've got cancer.
No.
Something wrong with my blood or my urine?
No, they're fine. But there is something.
Tell me.
You have a brain cloud.
Brain cloud?
There's a black fog of tissue running right down the center of your brain. It's very rare. It'll spread at a regular rate. It's very destructive.
And it's incurable.
Yes.
That was Tom Hanks and Robert Stack in one of my idiosyncratically favorite movies, 1990s Joe versus the Volcano, and I use it not to make fun of Joss's situation, which was dire, but to point out how a scene of a medical diagnosis in a modern film that is meant to be completely silly sounds like the serious diagnosis from 100 years before. It must have sounded silly to someone then because they finally got a doctor in who did a spinal tap and found out that Joss had tubercular meningitis. We think of tuberculosis as being a disease of the lungs of Doc Holliday, coughing his handkerchief full of blood. In countless films, whether Kirk Douglas or Val Kilmer or Victor Mature, you name your Doc Holliday of choice. And over a long period of time, too, it's something you get to think about for a while before it scars your lungs up so badly that you pass away. But it can play other tricks, too, and I'm using the word tricks as a euphemism for a disease that relentlessly ravages the brain until you're left with something that looks less like a brain than a soccer ball that long ago deflated and was left in the garage for 20 or 30 years. Joss died in Toledo 2 days after his 31st birthday. They said he was conscious and speaking to the end, although I doubt he made very much sense. Toledo's mayor, Brand Whitlock, said, "Most people will think of Addie Joss as a great baseball player, one of the greatest of his time, and while he was all that, and that is a big thing to be, he was much more. He was as good a man as a pitcher, as good a husband, as good a father, as good a friend, as good a citizen. He was studious and ambitious and serious. But when I say serious, I do not mean sober, for he had that rare and divine gift, a sense of humor. He was always cheerful. He seemed always to have some good news for you. He never whimpered or complained. He could smile even over the injury to his right arm last season, the arm that meant so much to him. I am sorry, very, very sorry that he is gone. But in the years of our friendship, I grew to know him so well that I am sure he would wish no sorrowful words spoken. Just a hail and a goodbye, and the memory of the smile that all who knew him will see upon his face when they think of him. And yet, the world is sadder and duller and meaner this morning without him." Joss died on April 14th, and when you read the little that has been written about him, you sometimes see the claim that he died right before or right after he was scheduled to pitch the opening day game of the Cleveland season. I suspect that this is total nonsense. Not only was his arm in bad shape, but he was a weak and dying. That's not to say that they wouldn't have loved to have him do it. It's just that it wasn't going to be in the cards regardless. That's why, as much as I love the past and as much as I mourn the people, places, and things from earlier in my life that no longer exist, I wouldn't want to live in the past. I don't fantasize about that. I surely wouldn't mind visiting, but I have no desire to stay. Because what killed Addie Joss was the past. He was murdered by 1911. But here's your Twilight Zone twist for this stop at Willoughby. The stop that we're opting not to make. The first cure for tuberculosis, the drug streptomycin, was discovered in 1943. Doctors had known exactly what it was for over 100 years, but they just couldn't do anything about it until that point. Had Addie Joss lived in our world, he would have been okay. But he couldn't live in our world. We, however, might end up living in his. We've been so negligent with antibiotic usage that drug-resistant strains of the bacteria are now commonplace. So even though we missed that time of sunlight and serenity that Rod Serling referred to, we may get to go to Willoughby anyway, and Addie Joss will be there waiting for us. I'm Stephen Goldman. This is The Infinite Inning. Gene Autry, having passed away years ago, complete singing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer to God for the 769th billion time. The Almighty never gets tired of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. "Somebody kill me," moans Autry, setting his guitar down on a cloud. "You're already dead," whispers Elvis, as he starts to sing Long Black Limousine again, turning up his amp to drown out Autry's screams. "The true Phantom Empire is time," Branch Rickey, who sits at his right hand, says, lighting up another healthful cigar. The smoke smells like freshly picked strawberries. "Time and patience. And one more secret, Mr. Free Agent. On the 20 to 80 scouting scale, the sweet spot is number 77. Welcome back to the show. This week I am joined for the second time, and the first time in about, 18 months? Mr. Grant Brisby, national baseball writer for SB Nation, television host provocateur, and we discuss the postseason and a bit of San Francisco Giants stuff for those of you who are interested in a team that was very, very good for a very long time, but now is pretty darn bad. I was going to say very, very bad, but we live in a world of Baltimore Orioles, and the lower boundary of very, very bad is low indeed. So perhaps we should just call the Giants, who lost 98 games 2 years ago and 80-something games this year, just bad, just mediocre. Okay. Frankly, we could curve them and give them an A. Whatever. Entropy being the defining rule of baseball and virtually every other aspect of our lives, I'm always curious how things become disassembled, and the Giants, who won a whole bunch of World Series under the outgoing administration, or aspects of the outgoing administration, Brian Sabian having been there since approximately the time of John McGraw, they clearly had some idea of what they were doing, or better than some idea. They didn't always do things in the most orthodox of ways, but they got the job done. In the last couple of years, that has changed, and one of the things that Grant and I get into is how that happened, that things became inverted. A couple of notes based on the time of our recording. Here is what we did not know: the outcome of either league championship series. We recorded on the eve of the final game between the Red Sox and the Astros. That was a few hours distant at that time. Friday's NLCS game had not yet happened. So where Grant was going to spend his World Series, where any of us were going to spend our World Series, whether in person or watching virtually from the couch, was a complete unknown. I'd also like to throw in that I characterized the ALCS as exciting and the NLCS as boring. I stand by that, but as I am speaking these words, as I said, there are NLCS games yet to be played. If that characterization should become dated because we had a couple of contests that were more excited by a Star Wars soundtrack 45 being played at 33, well, I didn't know yet. I will talk about that next week. I also just want to point out for your entertainment pleasure, one slip of the tongue on my part, there are always several. I discussed that with Grant a bit. There are some I can't fix, however, and this one was kind of awkward to try to clip, and besides, it's so silly I wanted to leave it. I tried to say the words moldy and mildewed. They come out... See, I did it right there. They came out mildy and mildewed, which is not a thing, and perhaps I should just see a doctor, but in any case, please forgive my usual cognitive impairment. Finally, on a couple of occasions during the episode, you will hear ding on the soundtrack. This is not me, this is at Grant's end, as he will explain. I don't want you to be confused by it. I don't want you to think that your toast is done or that your elevator has arrived or that you should turn the page. When I was a kid, I had these records. You know what records are, right? I had these phonograph records where there would be an accompanying book, and when the record went ding, you were supposed to turn the page and find out what Superman did next. This isn't that, unfortunately. One additional detail I left out of our opening. On the same day that Addie Joss passed away, the Giants' home, this is relevant to this episode, I suppose, since Grant is such a Giants guy, the Giants' home stadium, the Polo Grounds, were destroyed by fire. I assume this was just a coincidence and not some gesture of mourning on the part of Joss by baseball's weeping gods or something like that. But let no one say that 1911 was not without its trials and exciting events, because there were plenty of them. Before Grant rolls in here, I have one more thing to talk about with you. In a way, it's a continuation of last week's discussion of the defunct, there's that word again, Baker Bowl in Philadelphia. I didn't tell it when I talked extensively about the old bowl last week because it wasn't really relevant to that story, and I didn't really plan on telling it this week. And then the Astros and their binoculars intern guy were caught scoping out the Boston Red Sox, and it turned out to be much ado about nothing, or baseball swept it under the table, depending on your point of view. I kind of suspect the latter. It would have detracted quite a bit from the playoffs if we had a Deflategate right now. The Astros supposedly had that fellow out there, making sure that no one else was cheating. You know how in the Vietnam War there was this soldier who said this terrible thing, in order to save the village, we had to destroy it? Well, this is a much less consequential thing, but in order to stop cheating, the Astros had to start cheating. There's a tagline for a movie you don't want to see. In order to become the best, he had to become the worst. This fall, Chuck Norris enrolls in a private school for assassins. This story I want to tell you is one of the more famous examples of cheating in baseball history, though it was a very long time ago. And in the end, what amused me the most about it was I had a very hard time figuring out when it was, because all the books agreed that it was in one place, but in reality, it was at another time. I think I understand why it was misplaced, and it was the fault of the people who were there, or the people who reported what they said, and they got it garbled up in such a way that people forever after researching it would get the dates wrong. But I'm not sure. So here's the deal. And let me say ahead of time that the accepted date for this incident was 1898. You can look this up 22 different ways. You will find 1898 as the date. Alternatively, you will also have it told to you without the date, as in, one time, Ty Cobb said, I can't tell you, as someone who cares about baseball history and wants to give you the context for things, how much I hate once upon a time stories. Tell me when Cinderella was. Tell me where she was. That way I can understand the socioeconomic pressures on Cinderella, okay? So, once upon a time, the Cincinnati Reds go to play the Phillies at the Baker Bowl. The Reds' shortstop is a pretty good player named Tommy Corcoran, a veteran. He spent his career with the Dodgers, the Reds, and the Giants, even though those teams weren't always called those things. Those were the teams he was with. He was a good field, no-hit player. His career OPS is 75, but he got into 2,205 games, and I don't think it was just because they liked his company. I think his glove was good enough that he was able to get by all that time. He even set a defensive record, and I don't really know what this means or if it suggests that he was a great defensive shortstop or it just happened that all the balls happened to go towards him that day. It could be one or the other or both. But on August 7th, 1903, he set a single-game record that I believe still stands with 14 assists in 9 innings. One of the neat things about that is that he wasn't even told about the record until 1954. Tommy Corcoran lived into his 90s, and so even though it was long after his career that anybody cared about some of these records, baseball was just very, very disposable in his time, and in a lot of ways it still is. But they would look back and say, oh, hey, the guy who set the record for assists in a game is still around. We ought to give him a call. So they would. And he would say, wait, I did what? Because he didn't know. No one had said anything. They just moved on to the next game. On this particular day, September 17th, 1900, not 1898, but remember, we have to pretend it was 1898, the Reds were playing a doubleheader at Philadelphia, and Corcoran was playing shortstop and coaching third. He was standing around the third base bag when his spike caught on something. He thought maybe it was a tree root. It wasn't unheard of in those days. Professionalism in terms of parks and groundkeeping hadn't really set in yet. And really, when we're talking about baseball stadia at that time, we're talking about sand lots with some wooden bleachers around them. It's not much more developed than that. So he starts kind of kicking at the dirt with his shoe, kind of digging around at this tree root. And it comes loose a little bit, except it's not a tree root. It's a wire. Corcoran gave it a tug and more wire came out of the ground, stretching out down the third base foul line. He starts following it, pulling it as he goes. Fans are booing, telling the umpire, Tim Hurst, that he should throw Corcoran out of the game. Some threatened to beat me up, Corcoran said. But Hurst, a really great umpire, took over and the game continued without any trouble. Now, what he meant by game is his pursuit of the wire. So he's tracking this thing down across the outfield. Both teams and the umpire are around him now, following the wire too. And Batman is, and Sherlock Holmes, and the kids from Scooby-Doo. They are all, step by step, pulling up this wire, and relentlessly moving closer and closer to where the Phillies clubhouse rests in center field. To cut to the end of this mystery, which did not require Hercule Poirot to call all the suspects into the drawing room and interrogate them one by one before revealing he knew who the murderer was all along, sitting in the clubhouse, I imagine with a beer and maybe a bagel, was a reserve catcher, a deep reserve catcher, named Morgan Murphy. Morgan was in his 30s. He almost never played. He was the third catcher on the roster, and he didn't keep himself in shape necessarily either. Here's a description of Murphy as he arrived at spring training in 1898. Morgan is evidence that there has been no scarcity in the food supply in Little Rhodey's capital. Murphy was from Providence, Rhode Island. He is pig fat, had to put a V in his vest, and has had trouble in tying his shoes. Do you think a player meeting that description would have more or fewer pass balls than Gary Sanchez has in the last year or so? Anyway, Murphy was sitting there with his beer, his bagel, his binoculars, and a telegraph. And no, he was not moonlighting for Western Union. What he was doing was using the binoculars to steal signs and then relay the upcoming pitch to the third base coach for the Phillies. It was sort of the Paul Revere system. It's not that they were deciphering Morse code on each end. It was simply that the wire went to a plate under the third base coach's shoe, and he would feel a buzz, and he'd get, say, one buzz for a fastball and two buzzes for a strike, and then he'd flash some kind of hand signal at the batter, who now knew what was coming. And you'd think that maybe this would be kind of small beer, but consider this. The Phillies went 75-63 on the season, and this event happened almost at the very end. They went 30-40 on the road, that's a .429 winning percentage. At home, they went 45-23, which is .662. That is just one game off the current Boston Red Sox pace during the regular season. So that is a huge, huge dichotomy, and you'd have to think that this little system had something to do with it. Now, I don't think anything big came out of this. There was no lifetime ban for Murphy, who was just about done anyway, or for anyone else associated with it. I'm not sure who took credit exactly for thinking up the scheme. Again, in the books, it's often manager George Stallings, later more famous as the manager of the Miracle Braves World Series winning team, who got the credit or blame for it. But that's wrong because he wasn't there anymore. He had been fired midway through the 1898 season. The manager in 1900 was one Bill Schetzline. Mostly this story is told, if it is told, as, haha, what a quaint way of cheating these old-timey Phillies thought of back in the silly old days, and then they blame Stallings. So why is the date wrong? Why was it reported in newspapers of September 1900 instead of in the first half of the 1898 season? And the answer has to do with the way it was reported at the time. There was one very strange quote from the aforementioned umpire Tim Hurst, which, if deprived of context, like you don't actually see the date that the story was reported, would lead you to think that the story was happening, the wire was pulled, during the middle of the Spanish-American War. Here's how the conversation supposedly went when Corcoran stumbled over the wire. "Ha-ha," he said. "What's this? An infernal machine to disrupt the noble National League? Or is it a dastardly attempt on the life of my distinguished friend, Colonel John I. Rogers?" Colonel Rogers was one of the Phillies' owners at that time. The story continues. "By this time, umpire Tim Hurst went over for the purpose of investigating the cause of the commotion. Glancing at the apparatus concealed in the hole, he said, 'Back to the mines, men! Think on that eventful day in July when Dewey went into Manila Bay, never giving a tinker's damn for all the mines concealed therein. Come on, play ball and blow the colonel's mine.'" There is about nothing that makes sense about that statement made by umpire Tim Hurst. Number one, the game is being played on a fraudulent basis and he apparently doesn't care and wants the players to play on in spite of the quote-unquote explosive. But what's weirder than that is he's reported as saying something that sounds like the Battle of Manila Bay just happened. It hadn't. It had happened 2 years before, and not in July, but in May. It's a wonderful thing. It's a fantastic story in American history because it has to do with the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, who happened at that moment to be Theodore Roosevelt, a guy who was really, really eager for us to have a war with some decrepit old European power like Spain, and was really, really keen for us to get some overseas possessions via naval power. It happened that the actual Secretary of the Navy had gone out of town and left Theodore in charge. So when war broke out with the Spanish, over stuff happening in Cuba, which is right here, whereas the Philippines might as well be on the other side of the universe, he telegraphs Commodore George Dewey in the Pacific, tells him to take on coal and head for the Philippines. This second-level bureaucrat with a mustache and pince-nez was deciding to basically double up a war on behalf of the entire United States government, at which point he resigned, started this outfit called the Rough Riders, and became internationally famous and eventually president. Again, that was 2 years before. By 1900, Theodore had been in and out of Cuba and was well on his way to becoming vice president. That was via him becoming William McKinley's running mate in the election of 1900, which took place, what, about 5 weeks after Tommy Corcoran pulled the wire. Parenthetically, we have an election of our own coming up this November, not very long from now. Vote, 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 vote. I mean, legally, only vote once. But I am emphasizing by repeating many times the word vote that you should get out and exercise the franchise. I don't know who Commodore Dewey voted for in the election of 1900. It might well have been against McKinley's opponent and Theodore's opponent because he himself had kicked around running on the Democratic ticket against McKinley. So I do have a strong sense that whatever he was doing as of July 1900, it had more to do with presidential politics and not a whole lot to do with damming the torpedoes or the mines or whatever in Manila Bay, even if Tim Hurst was referring to some Dewey action that had taken place after the Battle of Manila Bay, it still wouldn't have been in July of 1900. That's because the Spanish-American War began in April 1898, an armistice was declared in August 1898, and the whole thing was wrapped up via treaty in December 1898. Now, there was still fighting going on in the Philippines, but on land, because great guys that we are, we had promised the Filipinos their freedom, then decided to stay and Christianize them. And when it was pointed out to William McKinley that the Filipinos were already members of the Catholic Church, he said, "Exactly." In any case, if there were mines in Manila Bay in 1900, they were most likely our mines. It was a brutal, terrible, dispiriting war, much like the Vietnam War later, although on a smaller scale. It tore the American populace apart in terms of being for or against it. Mark Twain wrote that the Stars and Stripes should be replaced with the Skull and Crossbones. It was one of the many moments in American history where we failed to live up to our own standards. And suffice it to say that if someday the United States is inducted into the Hall of Fame of Nations, this will not be a moment that will go on our plaque. So, in summary, the Phillies cheated, umpire Tim Hurst didn't know what year it was, said something that was a complete anachronism, and researchers ever since, in writing about the Phillies wire, have placed it in the wrong time as a result of what he said. And I have to express my gratitude to the Astros binoculars guy for not saying when he was caught, "Come now, I was merely espying what the Red Sox were up to, just as in June, General Eisenhower gazed through his own looking glass and watched the German preparations on Normandy Beach." Had he said that, 5 years from now, we'd all be reading books that said that the Houston Astros were caught spying on the Boston Red Sox in 1944, 18 years before they even came into existence. As always, mull that over, and as you do, we will pause briefly, and then I'll be back on the other side with Grant Brisby. Hang in there, won't you? My next guest is the senior baseball writer at SB Nation and a natural treasure. That didn't come out right at all, Grant. Let me try that again. My next guest is the senior baseball writer at SB Nation and a national treasure. He's not a honeybee. He's not a killer bee. He's a Brisby. Grant Brisby. How are you, Grant?
I'm doing very, very well. How are you doing, Steven?
I'm functional. My tongue is apparently not functioning at its highest level. However, this is one of the neat things about being a podcaster is just how much appreciation you have, even for the bad broadcasters who, you know, we may rip them for saying anti-sabermetric things or dumb things on the broadcast. But I just marvel that they don't just spout out cantaloupe, vampire every time they are supposed to say their name, because I cannot get a full sentence out without screwing up somehow.
No, I completely understand that. And I've done a lot of live TV over the last couple of years, and I pepper everything I say with, I think this is what's going to happen. I think, you know, and I can't shake it. So anytime I hear anyone talk without saying, I think, it's like, man, that person is a genius. So that is my bugaboo.
I think there must be like a secret way of doing it, or not so secret, because one of the things that everyone does that you find out when you do this is everyone buys time when they're thinking by saying, if I were to ask you a provocative question about Madison Bumgarner or something, you might say, while you cobble together the answer.
Right.
And the trick to not saying, because I have the same urge, is just every time you hear yourself about to say that, you just don't. I know that sounds dumb or basic, but just as you feel your brain forming that sound, you stamp it down and you just let a half second of silence go by. And it seems like hours to you, the person on the microphone, but in real terms, it's no time at all.
I agree. See, I just did it. It's coming up.
We've both learned a valuable lesson. I want to commend you for the following sentence, which you published during ALCS Game 4 last night in talking about Joe West's interference call, the one that cost Jose Altuve a home run. And I quote, "West, because he is bad, glorgled out beyond the infield."
reading that, I found myself conjugating to glurgle. I glurgle, you glurgle, we glurgle. Grant, you know me. We've met in person. Do I glurgle?
No, you're not a glorgler. I mean, it's like it's hard to explain. Joe West, you know, he glorgles out to the outfield. It's something between like an amble and a sprint. I mean, you know, a lot of umpires amble, some mosey, and I think he glorgles.
I worry when they glorgle because I had looked away from the TV for a second and they showed the glorgling replay of him moving at whatever top speed is for Joe West, who has been around since the 1970s. He's not a young man. I mean, he's been around longer than that, but in the majors since 1970s. And, you know, I'm still traumatized by that opening day at Cincinnati where the umpire just died moving behind home plate. And I worry about some of these guys.
Right. No, I actually just sort of rediscovered that story because I had forgotten about it. And it was incredibly awful. I mean, I watched the video. I don't know why I watched the video. And it's just, holy, I mean, that was, I was off my radar. And so when I picked it back up, I wish I hadn't.
The horrible thing about that, I mean, other than the death thing, was that Marge Schott, who owned the Reds at that time, was really pissed that she lost her opening day gate and complained publicly about that. And on the list of things that Marge Schott complained publicly about, like, you know, Hitler, well, not complained, praised, I should say, throwing out off the death of an umpire on your field because it cost you some hot dog sales has to be up there.
It is. I think that's the first bad thing I've ever heard about her. Man, I'm reevaluating my whole opinion of Marge Schott. No, she, I mean, what a monster she was. Just a real weirdo. I mean, it's like, I hesitate to cast the world between good and evil, but just broken in a way that we're not used to in the public eye.
It's very strange. And the weird thing, and we're discovering this in other areas too, is that rich people can be just as venal and cheap, or if not more so. I guess this isn't a new idea. I mean, we've had the Rockefellers and the Vanderbilts and whatever, but then you read about Marge Schott like having wet, mildy, molded carpet in the Reds front offices and be like, just turn it upside down, turn around on the other side. No one will know. And we just won't comment on the smell. Or one of the dogs, you know, licking the onion dip at the team celebration. And she'd be like, just stir it up so nobody can see the surface is broken. It'll be fine.
Oh, goodness. And you know what? Onions aren't good for dogs either. So that's a double. Double.
So one more thought on Joe West. I'm curious about your reaction to it. I was, as I said, looking at his record. RetroSheet has his complete list of ejections, which goes back to like 1977 or 1978. So he's got guys who are no longer alive. He got Chuck Tanner 4 times. He got Herman Franks. But how about Hall of Famers? He has ejected Joe Torre, Burt Blyleven, Bobby Cox, Whitey Herzog, Tony Gwynn, who's like a secular saint. Tommy Lasorda, Andre Dawson, and Tony La Russa. And they also give reasons. On June 8th, 1998, he got the then Orioles manager, Ray Miller, for, quote, second trip to the mound. Oh, it's you again? Too soon. Bye. I mean, what is it with that guy?
He's I touched on a little bit in the article. He just doesn't care. And I don't think he's necessarily trying to be anything other than his own, like he only has his own sphere, like that he orbits around. Like he can't put himself in any other place. It's just, he's going to be Joe West, guy who is umpiring, guy who is taking control. And that's his job and role in the universe, and everything revolves around him. He's a real quirky umpire, I guess.
We don't have a lot of them like that anymore. Obviously Angel Hernandez has found himself in the spotlight a bit this season, but I think the Statcast aspect of things, the fact that every pitch is tracked and decisions are now reviewable, has tamped down on the opportunities for umps to seize the spotlight that way.
Absolutely. And one thing I didn't touch on in my article, but I always believe, is that the quality of major league umpiring is so much better than most people give it credit for. Like, these are the, you know, maybe not the Mike Trouts of umpiring, but like they're at least like the Starling Martes of umpiring. Like, these are really good people who've been through a winning process. And you see it when you're watching NCAA World Series, when you're going to an A-ball game, I mean, you see the difference. And so I hate coming down on umpires a lot. I just was kind of trying to be cheeky because it's like Joe West is one of those guys that everyone has a problem with, right? Except I keep getting emails from people who are like really into Joe West, which, okay, more power to you. I thought that was like the one constant we all had.
I don't mean to compare Joe West to Donald Trump, but one of the things that relaxes me about people who support the unsupportable, who go to, say, Trump rallies or email you about Joe West, and again, there are orders of magnitude difference between the sinfulness of these people, is that I think every band has its fans. I think that if you can think of the worst, fakest pop act that you can name, you know, Milli Vanilli or something that wasn't even real, like they can sell out a certain sized arena and people will flick their lighters or their cell phones when they do their big hit. And so, like, when Trump does the lock her up chant or whatever, it's really just Rush doing Closer to the Heart at the end of the concert. And I don't think it's horrible on one level, and it has horrible implications for the rule of law. But at the same time, I really think that's all it is. Like, they're there to see him do his hits. And Joe West might be sort of the same deal.
I guess so. I will say, it just apropos of nothing, it would be really funny if, like, Joe West was like, yeah, I'm really into Jill Stein. Like, if the image of him coming out is just, you know, the typical crusty old guy. And anyway, I guess I use this kind of principle in reverse to when people send me hate mail and they're like, you're the worst writer, I hate you, and you've got an ugly face. And I go, okay, I have to stand back and remember, look, there are people who don't like The Simpsons. There are people who, like, they watched Richard Pryor stand up and it's like, ah, that guy's just not funny. And so you have to say, when you have a pool this large, there's going to be someone who hates everything. And I'm not saying I'm The Simpsons or Richard Pryor. I'm just saying, like, I can't let these emails and, you know, these comments, these Twitter responses form, like, my self-identity. You just have to remember there's a lot of fish in the sea, Grant, and that not everyone's going to love you because not everyone loves everything. There's people that hate Seinfeld.
I think that's part of it. And, you know, you sent me thinking back to something our old colleague Rob Nyer said to me once, because I think at that time he or I was on the receiving end of some of that kind of vituperative email. And I said to him, like, why do they care about my opinion? I'm just one guy writing about whatever team I had written about. If I'm wrong about that trade or that manager, general manager, whatever it is, then fine, I'm wrong. But why do they care? Right. And he said, they think we have the power. They think that we're privileged in some way, that we are putting ourselves above them in some sense. And they feel like they have to punch up at us.
Right. I guess that's entirely true. We do have the megaphone, and there is power in that. And so if I'm using my megaphone to say Joe West is a dingus and you disagree, it somehow gets to the core of that person, and they're offended and they have to lash out with an email that has sent from my iPhone at the end of it. So I appreciate that. You know, I don't take it hard. It's just people are funny. Can you imagine sending an email to someone about something you didn't like?
I've never even written a letter to the Incredible Hulk comic book saying I liked the last issue. Like, I don't know why anybody would care. There's Buckley, the conservative writer. I think one of his last books was titled Cancel Your Own Damn Subscription. And I think that's the bet Bill Buckley. I'm sorry. I'm really getting senile here in my young age. But I mean, I think that's the best response. Like, you know, if you don't like it, don't read it. But why would you spend the extra time to attack somebody, especially if you're an egg? You know, if you're like an egg avatar on Twitter or whatever, you're not really committed to the whole process anyway. I mean, just let it wash off of you. And if you like Joe West, or you like the way Manny Machado runs the bases and stomps on people, whatever, fine, more power to you. It takes all kinds.
Like, this conversation reminds me that I am speaking to the person who has received the all-time greatest hate mail. The literal letter you got from someone in, I think, Minnesota, when you were comparing, was it Mickey Mantle and Willie Mays?
Yeah, I think something of that nature. And he was just deeply, deeply offended that I had ranked. Did I rank Mantle higher than Mays? I don't even remember.
I think I know ranked Mays higher than Mantle. And his letter was, dear dumbass, or like, you know, it starts like that. And it's very like Ignatius J. Riley, just sort of like pompous, overblown language. How dare you? You chuff my sensibilities. Here's, you know, and he's like citing Pete Palmer stats from 1983. And it's that's my favorite all time. I got to find that. I've got a picture of it somewhere on my computer.
Ever since the Unabomber went to prison, he just has too much time on his hands. And some of those people keep coming back. And there was a time at Baseball Prospectus that I wrote about Matt Wieters, that I had done like a multi-part series ranking draft disappointments and prospect busts. And I made the argument that Wieters had not lived up to his prospect hype and his position in the draft, which I think was like third or fourth overall. And it pissed off Matt Wieters, as was communicated to me later, which is fine. I understand that. But subsequently, this one guy would just keep coming back in everything that I wrote and leaving comments about how stupid I was. Mm. And every time, for like a good 5 years, that Matt Wieters did anything good in a game, like, you know, hit one of his 11 home runs that year, I would get some kind of hostile email from that guy. See how stupid you are? See? And I wasn't trying to say that Matt Wieters wasn't a major league player or a decent one, just that here's a guy who hit 350 in the minor leagues as a catcher, and Baseball America had him highly ranked, and he just didn't turn out to be an MVP candidate in the major leagues. That was my only point, and it just really upset some people.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, if you were around, Matt Wieters used to be quite the controversial player because of Pecota. And because, you know, they spit out like this projection of like, man, this guy is basically Johnny Bench and we got to get ready for him. But yeah, the people who follow you around and leave comments, you had quite a few of them throughout your time. Just at SB Nation, there'd just be someone that would come in and be like, old dummy Steve. And like, they just go off on you, and you had written about like Tic Tacs or something, and they'd bring in something you'd written 4 years ago. So I don't know, man. People are they're just a wild, beautiful variety, aren't they?
That happened to me when I was looking for prom dates too. It was the worst experience because I just have that effect on people. So how do you like the postseason so far? Are you enjoying it? Because I have this weirdly bifurcated experience where I'm enjoying the hell out of the Astros Red Sox series, which has a lot of action to it. And the Brewers Dodgers series is a bit like going to the dentist in that there's a lot of standing around and striking out, but I don't feel like much has happened that I can even recall to talk to you about. So it's a very hot and cold thing where I'm elated on one hand and tortured on the other.
I think that's a fair read. I wrote actually after the first game of the ALCS, like, all right, we're going to need a little bit more excitement than that, because that first game was a turd. And, you know, it's the Astros and Red Sox, and these are two juggernauts. I think I saw the Fox graphic where it talks about the second most wins of a playoff matchup to the Yankees and Padres of 98, which I never would have guessed in a million years. But as far as like evenly matched teams, these are two juggernauts. They're going to be trading body blows. I think last night's game was just tremendous. One of the best games of the postseason, if not the best game of the postseason. And I'm right. There's nothing really to stick a pin in with the Dodgers and Brewers. I really enjoyed the Brandon Woodruff home run. I mean, that was great. They've been close. I think, let's see, 1-2-3 1-run games and a 3-run game and a 4-run game. And I mean, that's close for a playoff series that's gone 5 games. There have not been blowouts. And at the same time, it's a hard sell to get excited about Pedro Baez. You know what I mean? And just the way he pitches. It's a hard sell to get excited about the Brewers bullpenning. It's like, you know, the line about Pucci, like whenever Josh Hader's not in the game, everyone should be asking, hey, where's Josh Hader? Because if it's not Josh Hader, and I guess Corey Knable, and they've got some arms, but it's like they've got some arms. But if it's not a couple of guys, the Brewers pitchers are extremely Brewers pitcher. And that's not necessarily a slight. That's not a compliment. It's just, you know, to use a cliche, they are what they are. And they're not like that exciting. So I think that's part of it. I think it's just watching the Brewers. You're constantly waiting for Jesus Aguilar to come up. You're constantly waiting for Yelich to do something, and he hasn't. And if it's not those players, it's a bunch of guys that you're sort of aware of, and you're getting used to for the first time. And I think that's a part of the problem.
You and Ben Lindbergh both wrote about the bullpenning aspect of things in a way I hadn't really thought of, but puts a finger on one of the negative aspects of it, which is that it blunts the story of the game by depriving it of a protagonist. And I think you wrote this just this morning as we're speaking about how sort of having Clayton Kershaw in the game and having his postseason struggles and overcoming them in this particular start be a story is much more compelling than just seeing who is going to get wheeled out of the bullpen next.
Yeah, and that's entirely true. And I should say, you know, Ben Lindbergh did the heavy lifting with that. That is sort of, he wrote this big, long feature about it, and I piggybacked off it a little bit. But yeah, it's when you're watching Kershaw, you're watching, you know, future Hall of Famer, you're watching someone with this baggage, someone with monkeys on his back. You're watching someone who you know is brilliant, but for whatever reason has just had buzzard's luck in the postseason. And when you're watching the Brewers do the Brandon Woodruff and friends sort of game, that's great, except there's a part that you know in the back of your head, half of these relievers won't be around in 4 years. That's not being cruel. That's not being dismissive. That's just the nature of the game. You know, I went back and I looked at the relievers who were leading the league in, or in the top 20, 25 in the league in strikeouts per nine inning. And, you know, 3, 4, 5 years ago, a lot of these guys are just, you know, poof, you know, you've got one day you've got Al Albuquerque and the next you don't. And one day you've got Steve Delabar and the next you don't. And that's the nature of the bullpen. So you're conscious of this when you're watching the postseason. And that doesn't necessarily take away from the baseball game. Like if it's a great, taut, close game, you're still living and dying with every pitch. But at the same time, there's a part of you that knows that watching Clayton Kershaw do something like he did in game five is like more badass. Like that is something that you'll remember. That's something that'll stick with you when a Hall of Famer does something Hall of Famey. It's much more aesthetically pleasing, I should say.
I looked at this some years ago and I should redo it to see if it still holds up. At the point you made about relievers, I think I did it. I don't know if I did it in terms of war or what stat I was looking at, but the top pile of relievers in baseball seems to turn over about once every 3 years. And that is so rapid that it's shocking that, as you said, there are some guys who in a given year in 2015, say, who are huge household names, the guys who you feared seeing coming out of the bullpen in a game today, if we could name them, you would say, like, oh, yeah, I forgot about him. That's how rapid the turnover is.
Right. I mean, and then there's guys even like they're around for a decade plus, like Keith Fulton, that are hard to remember after a while. But just seriously, with the closers and then the hotshot setup, man, 3 years sounds about right to me. I think that sounds like some pretty sound research. And just one day they're there, one day they're not. And when you've got a bullpen full of them, I mean, maybe you've got like 7 Mariano Riveras, but you're probably going to have like 1 Ramiro Mendoza and 1 John Wetland. You know what I mean? It's 1 Jeff Nelson, and they're going to have varying careers, and then poof, they're going to be gone unless you're Mariano Rivera. So it's hard to get like super jazzed about a team riding its bullpen to the playoffs like the Brewers are trying to do. I'm not saying they shouldn't do it. I think it's a successful strategy. If I were a Brewers fan, I would be all in. But just stepping back as an impartial observer who's got to, you know, get the clicks and write the content, it's not like they're definitely fourth on my I really want to watch this team in the postseason list right now.
Appropriately, you said Brandon Woodruff and friends before, and I thought that sounds like one of those daytime talk shows that I probably wouldn't watch, you know, that you're in the waiting room at the doctor's office and you see that on the TV. You know, next we'll have cooking tips from Michael Strahan.
Right.
Stay tuned on Brandon Woodruff and friends. And that's the exact problem with it in a baseball game. And I want to ask your opinion about it more broadly. And listeners to this podcast will probably be switching off now because I've hammered on this kind of relentlessly, the aesthetics of bullpenning. And what I wonder is if endurance is a key part of baseball, pitcher endurance, and that the 3 times through the order penalty is a feature and not a bug. Because batting against a pitcher who is pacing himself is much different than batting against a series of pitchers who are going all out for 3 batters and throwing 100 miles an hour. And that results in a game of baseball that is much more static. You've heard all this before. It has more strikeouts. It has less guys running after balls or running around the bases. And so teams are very smartly preventing pitchers from being in that situation. But I wonder if we need pitchers to be in that situation and to kind of slow things down in terms of their own stuff, in terms of just blowing out the arm in every appearance and then getting out of there in 100 pitches, because it makes the game a more boring game.
I don't disagree. I think the optics of when a bullpen game fails are much worse than when a starting pitcher sort of tires out and then loses it in the sixth or seventh inning. When the starting pitcher kind of peters out in the sixth or seventh inning, it's familiar. It's like, you got to watch for these signs. You know, it's the signs that Dusty Baker missed with Mark Pryor, you know, in 2003. Like you gotta look at these signs, and you're watching for this. Whereas with a bullpen game, if one of those five relievers messes up, you feel like the manager gambled and tried to ride a parlay. Like the first guy had his stuff. The second guy had his stuff. The third guy had his stuff. But the fourth guy. And it's like, you're taking more chances. You're doubling down more. And I'm sure the numbers don't reflect that. I, the very smart people who are coming up with this are aware that this strategy works, but when it doesn't work in the fourth pitcher out of five completely blows the game, you just sort of, there's a weird taste in your mouth. It's like, yeah, if you go into the bullpen, one of these guys isn't going to have it. And so the optics are just a little bit weird when it comes to that.
I saw Keith Law tweeting about that idea. Somebody asked him, is the idea that if you go to enough relievers, you'll eventually find the bad one statistically valid? And he said, no. And I suppose it's not. There's no real reason why it should be. And yet that feels like a very real thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm not saying it is that it's going to be borne out in the numbers, but it feels like it. It's while watching the game, it's like, oh, dang it. Like, you kept playing those cards, didn't you?
Go fish.
There are games that many foolish lovers play, blindly chasing
You're listening to Connie Francis sing her 1966 B-side, Games That Lovers Play. This started out as a German song called Ein ganze Nacht, a whole night, dude wants to sleep over. Insofar as I can tell, we here in America took the melody, threw out all the lyrics, and reinvented the song. It was originally a single for Eddie Fisher, Carrie's dad, who took it all the way to number 45. The flip side on this for Connie was called Spanish Nights and You, and it only reached number 99. That was post-peak for Francis, of course, born Conchetta Rosa Maria Franco Nero in Newark, New Jersey. She had her first hit at 19, and then charted 14 top 10 singles between 1957 and 1962, including two number ones. She's probably best remembered for songs that didn't go to number one, Who's Sorry Now and Where the Boys Are. After 62, of course, the Beatles showed up and the entire musical universe changed. We'll take a break and then I'll be back with more conversation with Grant Brisby. I look forward to seeing you on the other side. Since we last talked, you gave up the McCovey Chronicles mm-hmm. website, and I was wondering, and this is something I used to discuss with you and with Justin Bopp when we were all working together. Justin was running the league side of things at SB Nation then, and it wasn't that you weren't doing a great job there. It was that selfishly I wanted more of your time.
Right.
Like you, I started writing mostly about one team, and then I graduated to a wider focus. That was me with the Yankees. And I happened to see Jeff Sullivan comment about this the other day, too, that he's divorced himself from being a fan of one team. And so those kinds of issues don't affect him as much anymore. And I wondered,
if now that some time has passed, you feel at all distanced from the way you felt about the Giants when you were kind of obliged to have a very laser-like focus on them.
Yeah, it's a complicated question thing because I differentiated, and these are all, by the way, text messages from Alameda County's emergency notification.
So who here is not satisfied with their Medicare plan?
I wish I could do a good Groucho Marx because I'd like to say you said the magic word, you know, and then a duck would fall from the ceiling. But anyway.
And did you hear that ad? That was an ad on baseball reference that just autoplayed. So I'm full of sounds now. I apologize. I closed the baseball tab.
I want Sean to have his 2 cents, so I'm happy about that.
Anyways, so with I separate my career sort of into to before full-time and after full-time. So before I was full-time in 2010, I think I became full-time March of 2011. Like, the Giants were my passion. They were – it's coursing through me, and, like, I have to get my thoughts out about Jonathan Sanchez or what have you. Once I'm full-time and I'm spending more time on McCovey Chronicles – I'm watching the games differently. I'm watching for content. I'm watching how do I put my spin on this? How do I relate this to the reader? And it didn't make me less of a fan. It just made me approach games differently. And my shtick was to be the writer who was a voice of the fan. It wasn't the guy in the clubhouse. It wasn't someone who was going to be worried about what Hunter Pence read that I wrote, anything like that. It shifted to where I'm looking for content and I'm looking for angles and what's going to hit and what's going to make people laugh. But at the same time, I'm still very much a fan and very much into it. Now, it's a little bit different because I still have a TV show where my shtick is to be the voice of the fan. I come on after the post game show and then we complain or we, you know, celebrate the different highs and lows of the game. So I still have that a little bit. But I don't think I'll ever be able to go back to the way I was before full-time, where it's just, I'm incredibly invested when this team loses, when Ryan Spielborgs hits the home run in 2009, that essentially eliminates the Giants from the wild card. Like, I'm devastated. I don't think that would happen now. At the same time, when I'm watching the 2014 World Series, I'm well into my full-time thing, and that Game 7 almost killed me. It almost murdered me when Blanco misses the ball and Alex Gordon looks like he's going to run all the way around the bases. Like, my heart was in my toes. So maybe it's just I'm able to have one foot in this arena where I'm still sort of kind of a fan because that's my shtick and I'll never fully divorce myself from it, even without the website.
One of the things that, to just go back to the topic we had earlier about hate mail and all that stuff, Buster only used to tweet this thing where different people would say that he hated their team, and that he had like a scoreboard or a tic-tac-toe board where almost every team had been represented as him hating it. And it's not if you write an article that's contra a team that you hate the team, because as you said, once your relationship to it changes where it's your profession, you're not really rooting for or against the team. You're rooting for stories. You just want the development that will give you something that will allow you to make your deadline and keep your job.
Last year, I got a lot of this when people were saying, boy, it must be tough for you being in Dodger Stadium while there's a World Series going on. It's like, not really. Like, it's I'm looking for good stories. I'm looking for something I can really sink my teeth into, and that World Series provided it. So bless you, Astros and Dodgers. I mean, I was very, very aware the way the World Series played out. I was going to be in LA for Game 6, and that was my 40th birthday. And the Dodgers, when they took a series lead, I sort of looked at the calendar and said, oh, they're going to win the World Series on my 40th birthday while I'm in a hotel room alone in Los Angeles. And I said, I have to wear that. That's fine. You know what? That's the universe making a good jape, and I gotta give it to you. That is funny. So, I mean, I think of that. But at the same time, like, I just, you know, even right now, the Red Sox Dodgers World Series, that sounds pretty darn good. Like, Astros Dodgers again, there's stuff I can do with that. I'm just looking for the good story. Now, I will say that when they lose, say in Game 7 of the World Series, and I'm walking out of Dodger Stadium, there is a tiny part of me that is encoded in my DNA that it's like, you know, and I'm not above that. But at the same time, if they were to win, I had my kind of outline of what I was going to write. And it wasn't like a tear was going to be shedding down my face. Like, oh, they're really going to give it to us on Twitter now, the Dodgers fan. Like, no, I'll be happy for Eric Steven. And it's fine. It's all fine. It's sports. But yeah, I got that a lot. Like, how do you cover the Dodgers? And you must be hating it. It's like, no, it's in the Pacific time zone. It's actually kind of sweet.
It's good that the writers have a guarded parking lot, because now, having voiced that thought about the Dodgers losing in Game 7, you can exit the building safely.
Oh, I know. I actually walk. I stay in Chinatown and I walk. Like, I walk from Dodger Stadium and get home or to the hotel in about 30 minutes. So I've got this down. Like, I'm very excited about the Dodgers making the World Series, because I already know that the hotel's like, it's convenient. They have a sushi place that delivers. There's Nashville hot chicken around the corner. Like, go Dodgers, I guess. I don't know.
Right. These are the things that matter. It's the creature comforts. It's not the team. When we last talked, it was between your first and second seasons of doing the TV show. And I had asked you at that time what it was like, you know, having to come on after all these losses, 98 losses. I know you only do half of them, but still. And this year there were at least a few fewer losses. And I was going to ask you sort of where the Brian Sabian era had gone wrong. But as I was listening to you talk, I had opened up the baseball reference page for this year's Giants. And as you know, from the way that baseball reference is laid out, they have pictures of all the players in descending order of their contribution to the team in terms of wins above replacement. And I now have, just in the last few seconds, developed a theory as to why the Giants are not doing well. And it's that they are falling behind in the beard department. They really do not have a beard quota that matches all of the other contenders this year.
No, I mean, Brandon Belt's, you know, working it. Brandon Crawford's a pretty boy, you know, who knows what he's doing. But yeah, no, it's the beards. I want big, bushy Charlie Blackman beards. Brandon Belt can get there. But
so obviously Sabian had a long quarter century, more than a quarter century, very successful run. And I know he wasn't the titular GM this year, but there is a change happening in that, having decided to move on from Bobby Evans, the new guy will not be reporting to Brian Sabian in any way. He'll be reporting directly to ownership. So I guess he's been removed from the line of succession. They went to four World Series. They won three. And at the same time, even going back as far as the last World Series win in 2014, they won only 88 games that year. And they haven't had a 90-win season since 2012 now. And of course, they're, as you well know, coming off of back-to-back losing seasons. So where did the wheels come off of this very successful organization that knew what it was doing for the longest time?
There was a time when Sabian was getting a lot of guff, and I don't think he necessarily deserved it, especially in retrospect. I mean, I was giving him some of that guff back when he would do things like sign Mike Matheny. And I'd be like, this guy can't hit. Why are you signing Mike Matheny? And the response is, well, catcher, defense, pitch framing, it's really important. And I was old school sabermetrics, and I go, oh, no, it's not. Catcher ERA is not there. And, you know, and then it turns out, kind of right. You know, when he's signing Ray Sanchez and he's saying, no, the defense makes up for the offense. And you know, back in the turn of the millennium, the strident sabermetrics were like, oh, no, you can't make up that much with your glove. And you look back and Ray Sanchez had like a 2-win season for the Giants. Jose Vizcaino was doing really well for them. He was right. So, and then he also incorporated sabermetrics a lot more than people thought. I mean, the Giants don't have a huge analytics department, but they've had a very productive one for a while. So he was getting a lot of grief for this. But at some point, sabermetrics shifted into just kind of a broader analysis where you're looking for things like spin rate, where you're trying to find out how to target people who might work in your ballpark, how to take someone who has this one skill and bring them on your team and say, don't throw that pitch here, throw it here, because we think that's going to be great. And then all of a sudden this low fastball becomes a high fastball that people can't catch up with. And those are the sort of analytics that the Giants fell behind on. They weren't creative enough. They weren't keeping abreast with the current state of sabermetrics, biometrics, the analytics. And that's where I think that's where it got them. The other thing, in totally separate arena, is their international acquisitions, international free agents, the young Dominicans, Venezuelans, has been awful. If you're talking pitchers who have appeared in games from an international, like an international free agent appearing in games in the 18T Park era, we're talking almost 20 years. The most appearances is Reyes Maranta, who is a rookie this year. Second was, I can't even remember, like fourth was Pablo Sandoval, and then endless. Like, these are pitchers. So there were four pitchers that the Giants have signed as international prospects who have appeared in a game over the last 20 years. And that is really hard to do. But at the same time, all of the skullduggery and the sort of sketchiness of the international market that is coming out now with the Dodgers and the Braves, it's really making me think that Giants didn't, like, I'm giving them an optimistic sort of look at it. Like, maybe they just didn't want to get their hands dirty. Maybe it was just too confounding and they'd rather focus on the draft. But that was a huge part of it. They don't develop international players. And other than Pablo Sandoval and before that, Pedro Feliz, like, it's killed them.
That's the same thing that the Orioles get dinged for. And people would say that Angelos was taking a principled stand. And until this year, they had traded away most of their international draft money. The problem is, as you said, it is ethically complicated, and we're learning just how bad that things can be in working in the Caribbean market, in the Dominican Republic in particular. But it's very hard to win that way. And the Orioles ending up where they ended, and their record of international prospects is very similar, if not worse than that of the Giants. I don't know how you can compete in this day and age if you're not going to give yourself access to one of the primary player markets, even if it does make you feel like you're doing something wrong.
Right. I don't know how to parse that, because it's going to make you feel squicky. It's going to make you do things like the Dodgers, where you create a spreadsheet of, like, you know, on a scale of 1 to 5, how much of a criminal is this guy? But at the same time, when you're not producing these players, you are putting, you're tying sandbags to your ankles before the big race. It's you're just not there. And if you're not getting young players, you're overpaying for old players or overpaying for the draftees that do pan out. And I don't know how you do it. You see it with the Giants. The Giants had no choice last offseason because they had no prospects. I kind of applaud the job that they tried to do, getting Evan Longoria and Andrew McCutchen, basically overpaying these guys, because that's all they could do to reshape the roster. It was a good idea, because the alternative was just to not do it, not spend Charles Johnson's money. And I don't know if you know anything about Charles Johnson, but I don't want him to have any money at all. So, I mean, sure, spend the money, try it one more time. And if it doesn't work, well, let's go back to the drawing board. And that's where they are now.
So they're kind of old. And one of the problems with that is that they've been very generous in locking up players to long-term contracts. So Brandon Belt will be 31 next year. Buster Posey and Brandon Crawford will be 32. Longoria, who is under contract until the midterm elections, by which I mean not the ones that are going to happen in 2 weeks, but the ones that are going to happen in 2 years in 2 weeks, will be 33. Johnny Cueto is signed forever, and you won't even see him for most or all of next year. The only veteran who isn't committed beyond 2019 is Madison Bumgarner. So with all that money locked up, with all these players who have been really, really good at different times in their career, but seem to be on the downside, locked up to huge contracts, how do they get out of this?
They don't. I mean, they are, if they spit out a bunch of young players in the next year or something, that's how they get out of it. If Joey Bart just shoots right up the charts, if Elliot Ramos shoots up and he's pulling a Soto or an Acuna and he's up, you know, as a teenager, maybe there's a way out of it. Maybe the Giants have had good luck with minor league free agents in recent years, going from Andres Torres to Derek Rodriguez. So maybe you're kind of sprinkling players like that around, but it's not going to be pretty. And I will say this for the Giants fans, is that they really, really get into these homegrown players, and maybe not even just homegrown players, because there was a love fest with Hunter Pence leaving that, you know, just like everyone had tears in their eyes and people would come to the games and he's sitting here with a 258 on base percentage and an OPS gets under 600. And he's getting standing ovations when he's going out to right field. I mean, that's just sort of the fan base. And you can call it, you know, maybe it's not as learned, or maybe it's nostalgic more than you would want a team's fan base to be. But they love these guys. And so Crawford, like, yeah, he's kind of a league average hitter, and he had one of the worst second halves you'll ever see. But people love him. People absolutely love him around here. And so him being around, underperforming for the next couple of years, like, that's not going to bother the Giants that much. He still puts butts in the seats. And that sounds weird to say about a glove-first shortstop, but Posey, Crawford, I mean, they love him. Now, Brandon Belt's different. Brandon Belt is very divisive, and for some reason, half of the fan base hates him. But I mean, other than that, the Giants are signing these guys to long-term contracts, and it has hamstrung them a lot. But at the same time, it's a feature, not a bug in some ways.
Did they feel the same way about Sandoval coming back? Were they just as sentimental about that?
Yeah. And I mean, with Sandoval, it was a little bit different in that I've talked to some beat writers who before might have put him on one of the worst guys to cover list if they had to write one. When he came back, they said, man, he is humbled. He is a great addition to this team. Like, everyone's having a lot of fun. So that was part of it. If he came back and he was, you know, still kind of a butthead, I think the sheen would have faded pretty quickly. But no, I mean, everyone loved it when he got in and pitched a very quick, clean inning. Like, that was one of the biggest, best stories of the year for the Giants. People bought shirts. They sold shirts, let Pablo pitch in the AT&T Park, and people just snapped him up. People love Sandoval. And I think, you know, that comes with winning three championships with the guy. So many endorphins and good timey chemicals have fired off in your brain. It's really hard to separate that when you are watching these guys, even if they're failing over and over again.
It's neat, isn't it, how homegrown players are different that way? I mean, as somebody who grew up watching the Yankees just sign free agent after free agent after free agent and punt all possible draft picks on that, so that in many cases there just weren't homegrown players on certain teams. It would be Don Mattingly was the one, and then there'd be 24 other guys who used to play with the Cardinals or something.
Right.
And you kind of feel jealous of other teams who are bringing their Wally Joiners to town or whoever it was at the time, these fresh-faced kids who are making good. And if the team is winning, I guess it shouldn't make a difference, but it really does.
It absolutely does. The Giants went from a stretch from Matt Williams to Pablo Sandoval where they produced no one, just no one. You know, they were always trying to get our Ray Durham and Edgardo Alfonso. We'll slap them together, but they were not producing productive players. Like, Marvin Bernard was the best between Matt Williams and Pablo. So when you've got Sandoval coming up, and he came up when the Giants are one of the worst offensive teams I've ever watched, and you're into it. And then, whoa, you know, they drafted Posey, and this guy's just rocketing through the minor leagues. And then Posey comes up, and then, you know, the first World Series happens, and then you've got Brandon Crawford coming up, and he had very poor minor league numbers. And so you're just anticipating Nathan Perez, but then he starts hitting. And you clear out room for Brandon Belt, and then this guy starts hitting. And then you add in Joe Panic right when you're considering Dan Ugla as your everyday second baseman. Joe Panic comes in, and he's your second baseman, and he makes one of the best double plays you'll ever see in the World Series, and he's kind of solidifying that double play combo. It is a better brand of baseball to, like, watch these guys come up and be surprised, constantly surprised by these prospects, and have them and the knowledge that they're in their 20s and they're going to be around until 2018. You're not thinking it's going to be ugly in 2018. You're thinking, man, these guys are here forever. It's an aesthetically just, like, beautiful brand of baseball. And I know how spoiled the Giants have made their fans over the last couple decades, like going all the way back from Barry Bonds to the new park, like that's spoiled. And then you get to this stretch, this wild stretch of three championships in 5 years with a homegrown core. I mean, I haven't even touched the pitchers of Lincecum and Kane and Bumgarner. I mean, that's wild that for all of that to be consolidated in a 10-year stretch or 5-year stretch, even, it's just like, how spoiled are you? Well, here's the karmic flip side is you're going to watch Evan Longoria decompose over the next 3 years. You're going to watch these guys get old. I don't know if Joe Panic's going to be back next year. It's going to be a mess. They might trade Madison Bumgarner. I don't think that's off the table with a new GM. And that's you know, here's the credit card payments. You were going interest only for a while. Now you got to start paying off the principal, and it's not going to be fun.
The party's over now.
The dawn is drawing very nigh. The candles gutter. The starlight leaves the sky. It's time for little boys and girls to hurry home to bed. For there's a new day dawning just ahead.
Just time for me to say that you're listening to the late Barbara Lee and the pianist Keith Ingham doing Noel Coward's 1932 composition, The Party's Over Now. It's a classic bittersweet song which somehow shows up in the classic video game Bioshock. I'll be right back after this break to wrap my conversation with Grant Brisby. Hang in there, please.
The thrill has gone. To linger on would spoil it anyhow. Let's creep away from the day, for the party's over now. Night is over, dawn is breaking. Everywhere the town is waking, just as we are on our way to sleep.
Baumgartner, as I said, is one of the few guys not locked up for the rest of time. They have a $12 million option on him for next season, which is what a bargain. I'm not even being facetious. By today's standards, that is a ridiculously cheap option for a really excellent pitcher, assuming health. But after that, he's a free agent. He'll be going on 30. You could imagine a trade in which they get two or three decent possibilities for him to go with Joey Bart and Elliot Ramos and fluff up the farm system to some extent. Is that a realistic possibility?
I don't think it's unrealistic. The thing with the Giants is that they, I don't want to be too cynical, but they're okay going 80-82 in the grand business part of it. And they just don't want to go 62-100. That's just, that terrifies them. And they have a big development going. The Giants ownership group, it's called Mission Rock, and it's on the other side of McCovey Cove. And it's going to be these sort of like lofts and live workspaces and businesses underneath. And they want to have a sexy baseball team over here so that people are investing in this real estate over here. They want a name. That's why they're trying to get Giancarlo Stanton. It's not because they thought they were one piece away from the World Series. They wanted one of the few players in baseball who would fit on a billboard and make people go, oh yeah, I've heard of that guy. That guy is different and unique. And that's why I think they're going to do a real full court press from Bryce Harper. I don't think they'll get him, but they want to sell the baseball team and they don't want to go through that rebuilding. And I think that that's going to be one of the major factors. And I think they will keep Baumgartner around because they're looking at their pitching and they're looking at, okay, Derek Rodriguez was a fine. He's locked up. He, you know, maybe he's going to be something next year. You've got Baumgartner, Andrew Suarez. If you go by FIP instead of ERA, this guy should lock down the bottom of a rotation. The pitching market is fantastic in the offseason this year. You can go get a Keuchel or a Charlie Morton, or, you know, you can go big on a guy like Clayton Kershaw. So they're thinking of it like this. Okay, so we solidify, we've got pitching. The bullpen's youngish and doing well. So maybe we can have a pitching first team. We just got to not have so many screw-ups in the lineup. And it's addictive. It's like, well, yeah, well, you might have Posey and Crawford's at least the league average player, and you're going through and you're doing the same damn thing that they were doing last offseason and it didn't work. But again, if you're trying to get to 99 wins, no, you're not going to do that. But if you're going to be interesting for most of the year, if you're going to get to 82 wins and keep people interested in the team generally, I think that's possible to do again.
Wait, I'm seriously confused by this. They feel like they have to incentivize people to buy San Francisco real estate?
I think, well, they want to jack up the prices as much as possible beyond ludicrous. They think if Giants are the hottest game in town, that it might go to like Plaid and not Ludwig.
You read my mind. I was thinking exactly that they were going to go to Plaid.
Yeah, no, they want to have a sexy baseball team, because they saw what that did when the Giants were the hottest team in town and they had the sellout streak. How is that not addictive? How do you not want to chase that dragon for the next 10 years? At the very least, they don't want him to be a dud. Like, yeah, it's by the ballpark, but you don't want to watch that team. I think that's the general idea behind it.
But you can't force it, especially when you have the Gorky's Hernandez Gregor Blanco roster. I just don't see how you get from here to there. I don't think the path goes through Steven Duggar or Mack Williamson or whatever. I mean, you really need a solid break with what's gone before.
No, and I don't disagree with that. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to make an apology for them. At the same time, this isn't a roster that you can flip the switch and get a billion prospects like the White Sox did a couple years ago. Posey, coming off of hip surgery, making 20+ million a year, he's not going to get you a top prospect. Brandon Belt, he's making fair market value. He's coming off the worst second half that he's ever had. He's constantly got minor injuries and nagging things. You're not going to get a top prospect for him. Down the line, Brandon Crawford, Evan Longoria. You're not getting top prospects for these guys for anyone other than Madison Bumgarner. So to say, rebuild, done. Well, you're going to have this same roster with two more prospects who might pan out. And that's not exciting. It's not as exciting as Madison Bumgarner. It's not exciting, especially if the prospects go the way of prospects and just sort of pooter out and don't do what they're supposed to do. There's always that chance. And it's going to be very hard sell to trade Madison Bumgarner and say presenting the 2019 Giants just as bad, but with two prospects.
I think that's a very fair point.
No, it would be different if Crawford were in his prime and it's like, yeah, trade that guy, get six prospects for him, or Posey or Belt. Like, you could have that conversation, but it's just they don't have a lot of pieces to trade. And that's sort of forcing the Giants' hand and making them, all right, let's try and push this boulder back up the hill. Let's reload. And I think that's what you're going to see again this year.
It's a vicious circle, because since that first round run they had where they had Posey and Bumgarner and then Zach Wheeler, who they traded for a month of Carlos Beltran or whatever, and it was a great month. But since then, the first round and the draft in general just hasn't rewarded them as much as it could have.
Yeah, no, and that's entirely true. And when you talk about the run of success they have, well, Posey's the number 5 pick. You've got Bumgarner and Lincecum is number 10 picks. And that's the genesis of all of this good timey fun, was that not only did they hit on these draft picks, but they had teams, trip over their own feet before them. The Rockies drafting Greg Reynolds instead of Tim Lincecum. I mean, you can go down the line. The Rockies drafting Casey Weathers instead of Madison Bumgarner. Like, no matter how smart a team is, if the Rockies said, no, we like Bumgarner instead of Casey Weathers, the Giants have a very, very different path. So they need those high picks. And so you can't miss on them. You can't miss on a Joey Bart. And I think they picked 10th again this year, which is that Lincecum Bumgarner sweet spot. So as long as they hit, maybe they can sort of turn it around that way. But they're not going to get their prospects from other organizations. They just don't have the guys to trade.
Briefly, do you have a sense, or what is your sense of what happened with Longoria this year? I know that part of it, just scouting the stat line, was that the park killed him. He hit .229 with 4 home runs in 59 games at home. But it's the lack of patience that's so weird to me, in that, with the Rays, his walks were falling off over the last several years, but he walked as many as 80 times a season. And this year he took 22 in 125 games. And what, 3 of those were intentional. So he took 19 unintentional walks. It's very strange to see him just hack away quite as much as he did.
The real sort of symptom here is age. I think he's cheating a little bit more. He's got to speed that bat up a little bit more, because you're thinking about it. No one's going up there to work a walk. Generally, that's not how baseball works. You're looking for the best pitch. You're looking for something you can drive, and that's how you get your walks. When pitchers are trying to nibble and be too cute, and so Longoria, earlier in his career, when he's 25 hitting 30 home runs, pitchers are scared of him, and so they're nibbling. He's looking for that best pitch, and he knows that he can adjust in the 2 strikes and he'll work out his walks. I think now he's just, his bat's just that much slower. Obviously the park's not helping him, but it's forcing him to chase and it's forcing him to go out of the zone more. It's forcing him to put more balls in play with weak contact. And I don't see that getting better unless there's an injury that was undisclosed. I think this might be what Giants fans can expect for the next couple of years, which is a player who defensively is pretty solid, who wins above replacement, says you're better playing this guy than some dude off the street. At the same time, you can't count on him to be your cleanup hitter.
You know, what's interesting is that usually that goes the other way. As players' bat speed slows down, they work the count more and the walks go up as they're taking fastballs, I guess, and waiting for some changeup or something that they can get around on. And I'll give you a classically Giants example of that, which is that Willie Mays in his career was never a 100 walk guy, even as respected as he was. He was like a 60-70 walk guy.
Right.
And then in 1971, when he was 40, his walk shot up to 112. He led the National League, and he was really done at that point. That was the end of classic period Willie Mays. He just couldn't get around on the fastball anymore. So it's weird to see the same explanation and have kind of the diametrically opposite result than what we're used to.
Well, do not forget that I am an idiot when it comes to sabermetrics. So there might not be any truth. This might be more anecdotal, but it just seems like someone who is never comfortable at the plate. It's someone who was just constantly getting themselves out, making the weak contact, tons of balls on the ground. I didn't look up his fly ball to ground ball ratio, but still, he was not a lot of fun to watch this year. Like, there weren't a lot of times where I said, like, ah, classic Longoria.
So last question, as we said earlier, you're going to go off shortly and cover the World Series wherever it is played. And you're either going to be spending some days in Los Angeles or Milwaukee, Houston. We don't know yet, but you talked about before the difference between being a part-time baseball writer and a full-time baseball writer, being a local one and a national one. What does it feel like for you? And this is not the first time you've covered the World Series, but what does it still have that Alice in Wonderland feel for you? Do you still kind of feel like a fan in a environment, in a celebrity, high profile, high pressure environment, and sort of say to yourself, like, wow, this is so cool?
Absolutely. I sort of look forward to this every year. This is going to be the third World Series I've covered. And the last two just happened to be all-time World Series. I mean, Cubs-Indians was, that was the only reason I was covering that World Series was they give you a matchup, like a matrix, and you say, okay, well, I'll cover the A's if they are in the World Series, or I'll cover the Cubs if they're in the World Series. And the only two teams, the only permutation that got me to both of the cities was Cubs Indians, because come on, that's a huge drought, kind of like Clash of the Drought Titans.
Right.
So I did that, and the response was good enough to where they said, okay, we'll just do this every year, no matter where it is. And then last year, Houston and LA was just another amazing World Series. And so this year, I think it's going to be like a 4-game sweep, and it's not going to be anything to write about just because that's the gambler's fallacy that's in my head. But I definitely look forward to it every year because I love going to the cities. I love sort of feeling the vibe. I went to Houston twice last year, and I love kind of exploring it. And Houston surprised me as a city that I wanted to visit more than I ever thought I would. Like, I really enjoy that city. I enjoyed being in LA and sort of walking around and taking cabs different places and just picking up on the vibe, because you think of it as, you know, no one really cares about the Dodgers there, but they do. When the World Series comes to town, like, everyone's talking about it. It's like this magical thing that goes through a region, and everyone all of a sudden is like focused on baseball. And I love being in the cities while this is happening, because there's that sense like this might not happen again for 30 years, 50 years or whatever. Like, this is special, and everyone in the city knows it. When you're checking into hotels, when you're eating out, like, everyone just is baseball, baseball, baseball. And you don't get that ever.
Do you think that part of what you bring to it, as opposed to, say, like a Tom Verducci or a Ken Rosenthal or something, is that people like us are armchair quarterbacks a lot of the time? I mean, you're in the ballpark now more than you used to be, but at the same time, like, we're not traveling from city to city. We don't have the opportunity to get jaded or used to the idea of just, you know, staying in hotels and doing the whole kind of beat writer experience. So we're rested. We're ready. We're ready to be wowed by the experience.
I think it's 100%. And I think it's also part of what my going to what my strengths are. Like, I'm not going to be Enoceris. Like, I'm not going to talk about spin rates and figure out like how players are doing that. Like, that's his beat and he's great at it. I'm not a beat writer. I'm not traveling with a team. I'm not going through the grind. My whole kind of brand is that I've been a fan. I know what you're thinking. Even when the Dodgers are winning, I can put myself in the mind of a Dodgers fan and sort of extrapolate from there. Like, how are they feeling? What are they worried about? How did this make them feel? Why is this important? And that's, if I don't have that, I don't have anything. And so when I'm visiting these places, I'm still trying to be professional. I'm still trying to not be, you know, boo Dodgers or yay Giants or whatever. Like, I'm just trying to get into the mind of a fan and saying, this is why this is funny. This is why this is important. This is why you should be mad about this. And being there and sort of picking up on the vibes is a very important way to do that. And because I haven't gone through the grind, I'm very much into it. Like, I'm excited. Like, I get to go back to the hotel room or stay in the press box and write without having to, you know, go get a glass of milk for the kid. Yeah, I love my sweet kids, but it's not the most immersive environment. So this one week or 2 week stretch out of the year where it's like I am just all focused on baseball is cathartic to me in a lot of ways.
We could do a parenting show about how I love my kids, but God, do I need a break from them sometimes. The two are not mutually incompatible ideas at sort of different points in your life cycle. Folks, if you see Grant at the World Series, he's just as starry-eyed as you are. And as I said at the outset, go up and shake his hand. Don't curse me for saying that, Grant. But he's one of the most wonderful people you'll ever have the chance to meet. He's a national writer at SB Nation. Thank you so much for doing this, Grant.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me on. It's good to chat with you, as always.
By the all-seeing flounder on the floor of McCovey Cove, we have come to the end of another episode. You can follow Grant Brisby on Twitter at Grant Brisby. He makes it very easy for you. As for me, you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Well, it's short for Go Register to Vote Right Now, says Stephen Goldman. You can also write us, by which I mean me, at infiniteinning@gmail.com. And there's a Facebook group. Go to Facebook, search on Infinite Inning, knock, I will let you in. Soup and salad bar is always included with the price of your meal. Finally, if you have a spare moment, please go to the podcatcher of your choice and rate, review, and subscribe. It really does help. And if your podcatcher doesn't let you do those things well, go pet the cat. The cat needs some attention. He's looking a little lonely right now. We have a sponsor these days, but nevertheless, this episode is brought to you by the number 25. Our producer is Wheeler X Nutt. Our theme song, which you are hearing now and have in fact been listening to throughout the episode, is called The Infinite Man, and it was a co-composition of myself and Dr. Rick Mooring, who says, don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes, but say they're wearing sunglasses, then don't be a sucker. Well, if the goldfish don't overthrow their bowls, declare themselves our new seafood overlord, and cause the price of sushi to plummet, I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the infinite inning.